We haven't seen any evidence that the work was done. All we have are promises.
The Anchorage Assembly says it's not ready to approve a settlement over a project it never approved. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 28th. Good evening. I'm Liz Ruskin, filling in for Casey Grove. Also tonight, concentrations of dangerous forever chemicals are higher than previously thought in some Anchorage and Fairbanks lakes.
We detected PFAS in all of the water bodies that we tested.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson wants to pay a contractor millions of dollars for work it did on a canceled homeless shelter and navigation center. But assembly leaders say the body must approve that settlement or it's illegal. The dispute goes back months. The Bronson administration admitted in October that it authorized Roger Hickel Contracting to spend nearly $5 million to build an East Anchorage shelter without getting assembly approval, which is against city code. The assembly then effectively killed the project by voting against funding for the shelter. Now, the city wants to settle with the contractor for roughly $2.5 million to cover work it's already performed. Assembly Vice Chair Chris Constant says that can't happen.
The Assembly voted down the project in October, and that depropriated the money. The money was no longer in that capital account for that project, so the money isn't there.
The city administration disagrees. In a memo to the Assembly Friday, Acting Municipal Manager Kent Kohlhaas said the Assembly appropriated the money for the shelter in May, and that means the city can use those funds to settle with the contractor. In response, Assembly leaders wrote that it would be illegal to make the proposed settlement without additional Assembly action. In December, the Assembly passed an ordinance that requires its approval to pay settlements of more than $50,000. Constant says the city could still issue the settlement to Roger Hickel Contracting, but the Assembly has to approve it first.
The expectation is that they'll bring a resolution before us that sets out the terms that they believe are right. We haven't even seen the invoices. We haven't seen any evidence that the work was done. All we have are promises.
In his memo, Kohlhaas wrote that the Assembly can request relevant documents from the contractor. A spokesman for the mayor says the administration is working on a formal response to the Assembly. Constant says that if Bronson decides to issue the check to the contractor without Assembly approval, it would, quote, be a knowing violation of the public trust. In Juneau, legislators are 6 weeks into their session. The big controversies so far are education funding and employee pensions, and, as always, the size of the permanent fund dividend. Here to discuss it with us is Alaska Beacon reporter James Brooks. James, is anything happening there at the Capitol, and how is the mood?
Hi, Liz. It's actually pretty quiet in the Capitol this week. There's a fair number of legislators who are headed out to Washington, D.C. this week in order to lobby support for the Willow Oil Project. And it seems like, it feels like right now, that we're in the middle of the session. Legislators have had about 45 days now to get to know each other, to get up to speed, because remember, there's a lot of new faces. More than a third of the legislators are new this year.
Let's discuss what the governor wants. Governor Mike Dunleavy revealed a new budget plan in mid-February. What are the major elements there?
Yeah, the governor has proposed a few budgetary solutions for some of the problems that Alaskans are seeing now. For example, the food stamp issues. There's a lot of people who are going hungry right now because they haven't been able to get access to food stamp benefits. The governor's proposed funding for new workers to process those food stamp applications and move more quickly on that. He's also proposing more funding for public defenders. That's a constitutional requirement, but right now it seems like some of those agencies might be falling short. He's also proposed a permanent fund dividend of about $3,900 per person. At $2.5 billion, that's the largest single item in the budget.
Tell me about the proposed increase in per-student spending. Where's that coming from?
In the Capitol, we've heard a lot of presentations from school district officials, school superintendents, ordinary parents and teachers who have said that local schools are really suffering right now from the effects of inflation. School supplies, fuel, electricity, basic costs have gone up enormously for school districts. And the state of Alaska pays much of the cost to run K-12 schools throughout the state. And one of the key components of that funding is what's called the base student allocation. It's how much the state pays school districts per student. There's been a lot of talk about increasing that BSA, as it's known, in order to compensate for inflation. We heard earlier this year that to match what schools received in 2015, the BSA would need to rise about $1,300. And that works out to more than $260 million statewide. So that's a pretty big ask. There's been some questions about whether the state is getting a good enough return on its money, particularly from Republican lawmakers who want more accountability measures. But we also heard today from Democrats and independents who noted that last year the legislature, at the urging of the governor, passed the Alaska Reads Act, which does impose some of those accountability measures, but didn't include much additional funding. And so they're considering the BSA increase to be the second half of what's needed.
And if you had to guess, where do you think the BSA increase will end up? Do you think a significant increase is realistic?
I think the most likely scenario right now is that the legislature includes a one-time bump in the budget, and any permanent increase seems like it would be an issue for next year.
I was really struck by something Senate Finance Co-Chair Bert Stedman said. He says the state can't afford a dividend of the size the governor wants. He said, we're going to have to make a choice. Do we want to teach our kids to cash checks, or do we want to teach them to read and write and do arithmetic? Is that how it is that increased education spending or any other big ticket item will come at the expense of the dividend?
It's really turned into a tug of war, and you're not wrong, because legislators so far have been unwilling to consider tax increases or new revenue that could be done quickly. So if you're looking at the problem for this year, it's a tug of war between the dividend and every other priority the state has. So if you, for example, were to take the governor's proposed $3,800 dividend, cut $1,000 off of that, you could have a fairly large dividend and cover both the BSA increase and the spending that's been proposed already.
Do you have a sense of whether lawmakers have made progress on resolving these big issues?
I think for the first part of the session, the weeks that we've seen so far, legislators are getting their hands around the problems. I think in the days to come, we'll start to see them grapple with solutions. Okay, what ideas will work best to fix the problems that they now have a better understanding of?
James, thank you very much.
Thank you, Liz.
That was reporter James Brooks, who covers the state legislature for the Alaska Beacon. Eyes are on the winner of last year's Iditarod as teams gear up for this year's race.
We're going surfing, you're making a wave, and I'm going to catch on to it with you, you know?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Parents go to great lengths to protect their little ones. When it comes to protection from childhood diseases, go with the safest, most effective choice. Start strong by getting all recommended vaccines for your baby by age 2. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. That's vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Testing of 16 lakes and other waters in the Fairbanks North Star Borough and Municipality of Anchorage found varying levels of PFAS. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the testing expands knowledge about water contamination in both areas by the so-called forever chemicals.
The 16 waters tested include 9 lakes, a creek, a slough, a pond, and 3 gravel pits. The PFAS contamination ranged from a low of 2.8 parts per trillion in Belaine Lake in Fairbanks to 952 ppt in Lake Spinard in Anchorage. The data is compiled in a report by Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
The report reflects samples that we took in water bodies in Anchorage and the Fairbanks North Star Borough in 2021 and 2022. We detected PFAS in all of the water bodies that we tested.
ACAT Executive Director Pam Miller says the test results raise concerns about exposure through associated groundwater wells and recreational use.
These are waters that people use for fishing in some cases or for pets. In some cases, people use them for swimming. So we think that this is really a critical public health issue.
PFAS compounds bioaccumulate, and Miller says there are already state fish consumption advisories in effect for some of the waters tested.
The levels that we found in most of the water bodies, both in Anchorage and the Fairbanks North Star Borough, are similar to water concentration levels that had been measured by the state of Alaska that resulted in the ADF&G consumption advisories.
Miller urges the Alaska legislature to approve a bill that would require airports to phase out use of PFAS-containing firefighting foams, a primary cause of ground and surface water contamination.
But we also need enforceable and health protective drinking water standards for PFAS as a class. And then we need surface water action levels to protect aquatic life and public health, because we know these chemicals can affect our health at extremely low exposure levels.
The Division of Spill Prevention and Response at DEC is going to be working on a regulation package to update the cleanup levels.
Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Site Cleanup Manager Bill O'Connell says the agency will use the latest science to develop the new PFAS regulations.
As toxicity data becomes better and more defensible, that allows the state to use that toxicity data to establish cleanup levels.
O'Connell says the updated regulations could be out as soon as late this spring. He says the DEC oversees response to PFAS contamination at 140 active sites in the state. Meanwhile, the EPA recently announced the award of nearly $19 million to Alaska to address PFAS drinking water contamination. An agency release says the money will be distributed through grants to communities. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The State Department of Transportation has scaled back the road plan for a Department of Natural Resources agriculture project west of Nenana. DOT Northern Region spokesman John Peralt says a plan to extend the Tauchacket Access Road has been shortened by about 14 miles.
It was originally proposed that in addition to renovations and improvements to the existing Tauchacket Road, that there would be a 19-mile extension added onto the end of it that would go all the way down to the Kantishna River. There was some community outcry against this plan, and in conversation with DNR, we rescoped to only go 4.7 miles past the current end of the Tauchacket Road.
Peralt says that will take it across the DNR Ag project, but no further. He says the DOT decision reflects local concerns about subsistence impacts of the road and future development it could bring.
Even though no plans existed, the community was left with a lot of question marks, and that created a lot of concerns. So DOT is no longer applying for a Corps of Engineers permit to build the road any farther.
The state auctioned off more than 2,000 acres in the Ag Project area last fall and expects to hold a second sale. Some area residents are concerned about environmental impacts of large-scale agriculture. They question a state assertion that it will help address food security in Alaska. After days of impassioned testimony, the Alaska Board of Fisheries voted to change escapement goals for chigniks' early and late sockeye runs, which have been depleted for years. But the fisheries management will keep an important precedent. As KBBI's Corinne Smith reports, the board voted against the Department of Fish and Game's proposed changes, siding with chigniks fishermen.
At last week's meeting, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game proposed combining the escapement goals for chigniks' early and late sockeye runs. But the Board of Fisheries voted to maintain the two separate goals. Escapement is the number of fish that make it to their spawning grounds. Many chigniks residents and fishermen testified against the proposal. Some, like commercial fisherman Axel Kopen, worried that it would harm biodiversity and hurt the stocks in the long term.
The department has also failed to model the possible negative effects of these drastic changes and the impact it will have on the genetic diversity, subsistence, and commercial fishermen of the chigniks area. This process has not been open and transparent, nor peer-reviewed, as good science must be.
Chigniks' runs crashed in 2018 and have been extremely low since then. The state designated chigniks' early sockeye run as a stock of concern last spring. The department says the single goal could allow fishermen to harvest more fish sustainably. But that claim came under scrutiny during public testimony. University of Washington fisheries professor Dan Schindler.
There is zero scientific basis for supporting 105.
He says the runs are independent of each other and should be managed as such, especially since one is a stock of concern.
You run the risk of preventing recovery of that early run. So you may have interim within season escapement objectives, but without accountability, which is what occurred when you had an early run escapement goal that was explicit, you do run the risk of over-harvesting that early stock.
During board deliberations, Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang said the department's review shows that a single escapement goal would allow fishermen to maximize how many fish they can sustainably harvest.
I'm convinced the single escapement goal meets our obligations as a department to maximize yield. And I think we can manage discrete stocks. We do it in the Copper River, we do it in other drainages using single escapement goals. So I stand by the staff's decision to have a single escapement goal.
Vincent Lang said the escapement goals proposed by the board probably won't allow for the largest sustainable harvest possible. But board chair Marit Carlson Van Dort said stakeholders had testified in support of foregoing harvest to allow the runs to recover. The board passed her amendment, which created new escapement goals for both the early and late runs. It also increased the escapement necessary to open commercial fishing.
And that's intended to ensure a strong start to escapement and enough to provide a decent and reasonable opportunity for subsistence harvest in that area. We heard in public testimony that, you know, these runs are very distinct. They are visibly distinct. They look different. They taste different. There's a lot of things that are different about them, and consequently, they're used differently by subsistence users.
Carlson Van Dort also said that Fish and Game didn't allow for enough time for the public to review what she called a, quote, wholesale tectonic change in the fisheries management. With help from Izzy Ross in Dillingham, I'm Corinne Smith in Homer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Matson, delivering the goods and materials Alaskans depend on. On Facebook at Matson in Alaska. Matson, supporting public media in Alaska. Grant applications are now being accepted for tribal justice grants through the U.S. Department of Justice. Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation, or CETAS grants, fund tribal courts and tribal law enforcement, open to federally recognized tribes across Alaska. Applications are open until March 21st. Learn more at atjrc.org/CTAS. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tribal Justice Resource Center.
Verizon cell phones stopped working across Prince of Wales Island in early February, leaving residents in the dark until 4G comes online. But it's unclear if or when that will happen. And now, a retailer for a Verizon rival is eyeing the problem as an opportunity for growth. KRBD's Reagan Miller reports.
Verizon had spotty service across much of Prince of Wales Island, especially Craig and Klawock. But since the provider shut down its 3G networks, customers were left without any service at all, and Verizon hasn't said when or if it'll restore service to the island. Taylor Barrett is the Associate Director for Prime Communications, the largest AT&T-authorized retailer. He says his company is looking at sending representatives from Ketchikan over to help anyone interested switch to AT&T, which has a 4G network on the island.
If we can get some good traction with the people on Prince of Wales wanting us to come out, that we would expense that out in order to go out and support everybody and, one ferry ticket for us versus, you know, however many for everybody that needs to switch service. Sounds like a better deal anyway.
Whether or not the trip happens is based on how much community interest there is in making the switch. Barrett says that if the plan goes through, representatives from the AT&T store in Ketchikan would probably head to Craig and set up tables at the local fire department or grocery store.
People can come down and they can come and switch their service. We can order phones for them, or if their phones are unlocked, which a lot of Verizon phones are, we can just set them up with a SIM card and then they'll be able to get service out there instead of just being left with nothing, wondering what they're going to do.
Catherine Milton is a Thorn Bay resident who says she was left confused and without a reliable way to make calls and texts when the shutdown happened. She traveled to Ketchikan to sign up with AT&T in late February. Though she says service is strong in Craig and Klawock, Milton says her new provider doesn't work as well in Thorn Bay as Verizon did. But she says it's a relief to know she was connected again.
It works. I'm able to make calls. When I go inside buildings, it looks like that service kind of really drops, but at least I'm not kind of stranded anymore.
But Milton was left bothered by the surprise drop from Verizon, and even more bothered by what she considers a lack of transparency from her former provider.
It made me feel completely unvalued.
Now she says she doesn't know if she can trust any business to offer service to the island.
Living here is just a big experience of, you know, living in a place that's hard to get to, that has a low population, so it's a low priority for companies.
Milton says she doesn't know how many island residents would make the switch to AT&T. She thinks some might consider another network that uses AT&T towers, like Cricket. A representative from Verizon didn't return a message from KRBD on Tuesday. The Verizon 3G shutdown affected other communities in Alaska, too, like those on the North Slope and in Juneau and Kodiak. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Just 33 teams are signed up for this year's Iditarod, the lowest number in race history. Despite the small turnout, it's a fiercely competitive field led by defending champion Brent Sass. As Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports, most of last year's top dog teams will be chasing Sass this year, though some of the mushers on the sleds behind those dogs have changed.
On a foggy day in Big Lake, just a week before the start of the Iditarod, musher Kelly Maxner is pulling dogs from their kennels for the final set of training runs.
Okay, you hold her, okay?
He's aiming to pick the 14 that will make up his Iditarod team, but he has a problem. Too many fast dogs.
I think we have probably 8 that are borderline dogs. I mean, I got to choose 2 of those 8. So it's very tough.
They're not just any dogs. They belong to 5-time Iditarod champion Dallas Seavey, who finished 2nd to Brent Sass last year and who isn't racing this year. Maxner has never finished the Iditarod in the top 10 before, but he's hoping with Seavey's world-class dog team to have his best finish yet, without the intense pressure that big-name mushers feel.
I'm just going to kind of run a schedule that we've been running in all our training runs, and it's a good schedule. I mean, it's a top 10 schedule for sure.
Maxner is one of the teams running this year's Iditarod with a shot at challenging reigning champion Brent Sass. Nearly all of last year's top 10 dog teams are back, but a few have different mushers behind the sled, like Eddie Burke Jr., who's running Aaron Burmeister's dogs. Other prominent competitors returning to the race include Bethel's Pete Kaiser, Nick Petit from Big Lake, Danish musher Mille Porseld, and Jesse Royer, the Montana musher and horse wrangler. Sass says he knows he's got a target on his back, but last year's win also gave him confidence.
When you win the Iditarod, it is the top. It's the top of the food chain, you know, and I think the biggest change for me is that I came out of it going, you know what, the last 10 years, I did figure something out. I did learn from all those mistakes I've made over the years.
That confidence helped Sass cruise to a Yukon Quest 550-mile win in February with most of his Iditarod team. In the 1,000-mile Iditarod, he'll have not one but two CV dog teams challenging him. Australian musher Christian Turner is running the dogs of three-time champion Mitch Seavey. Turner had a unique preparation for this year's Iditarod.
I do a lot of team sports in Australia, and I surf nearly every day.
Turner last ran the Iditarod in 2015. While he doesn't necessarily consider himself a favorite in this year's lineup, he won't count himself out either since he's running Mitch's team.
I'm no Dallas and I'm no Mitch. I haven't been in that position multiple times, so it's hard for me to tell. But as I said, I'm going to do the best I can. And, you know, if I'm in that position, I'll just keep trying my hardest.
Last year's third place finisher, Jesse Holmes, is also a strong contender. He's going into this year's Iditarod with a different kind of bond with his main competitor. Last year, Holmes invited Sass to help Alaska coastal communities rebuild after Typhoon Murbach devastated the region. As he tore down a storm-damaged home, a wall collapsed, trapping him. Sass was the first to the scene.
When somebody saves your life, you know, and they're the first face that you see, you know, whenever you're getting drug out of a near-death situation, I mean, you know, you look at them differently.
Holmes broke his wrist and a couple of ribs. His hand was too tender to drive a sled until November, and he lost 15 pounds from his already lean body. Still, he says, the experience motivated him to train harder than ever, and he's not going to take it easy on Sass.
I kind of thought about telling Brent, hey man, you know, bring your board shorts, you know, we're going surfing, you're making a wave, and I'm going to catch on to it with you, you know?
But he says there's likely going to be a lot of other strong teams riding that same wave to Nome. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Alex Trinan.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early and Lex Trinan in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Izzy Ross in Dillingham, Corinne Smith in Homer, and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Madeline Rose produced tonight's show. I'm Liz Ruskin. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. Planned gifts as a bequest to your local station builds a legacy that is long-lasting. Thanks for considering this option. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.